Hello and welcome back to Crest in the Afternoon. I'm Pat Odie-Marie. I'm subbing for Al this afternoon because he is working on the spring membership drive for Ave Maria Radio. So I'm excited about our next guest. It is Dr. Roberto De La Novole. I hope I said that right. He's an assistant professor at the Department of Theology at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg, Maryland. Welcome, Dr. De La Novole. Did I say that right?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Pat. I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, well, this was an interesting article. I teach at a local Catholic college, and I felt like I was reading about my own classes.
I figured that many people would find it resonates with their experience.
Yes. So, can you explain for our audience kind of the issues that you have kind of found and brought forward about this introductory theology class?
Sure. So the article that you're referring to is the first part of a three-part series that I'll be publishing with Church Life Journal.
Oh, wonderful.
So be on the lookout for parts two and three.
I will.
And the article really arose as the fruit of my 5 years of teaching, so not that long, but what I've seen in those 5 years has helped me realize that perhaps the approach that many Catholic universities and many Catholic theology instructors are taking are not adequate to the level of our times. That's a phrase that the philosopher Bernard Lonergan, Jesuit philosopher and theologian, uses very often. He says, we need to speak to people at the level of our times. Mm. And so I've discovered over and over in the classroom that many students simply cannot understand why a university would require them to take a course in something which, in their view, there's no objective knowledge possible.
Right.
And so at the end of the day, issues having to do with the good life, what actually would lead to flourishing for people, is there a God, right?
Yeah.
Do I have an eternal destiny? Can I even know truth about matters, outside of science? Though many of my students themselves doubt whether we can even know scientific truths.
Right.
So I dub all of this a relativism.
Right.
The problem, the philosophical problem of relativism, of course, I'm not the first person to speak of this by any means.
Exactly.
But it is something that I think is posing a huge problem for Catholic theological education. And I go as far as to call it a crisis. And I think that is correct. But I'm curious to hear from your teaching experience, too, whether you think the situation is as grave as I paint it to be. But I can't say I've heard from many people that the article has resonated with them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I read this, I thought, oh, my gosh, this guy, I feel his pain. It is the idea that that there's no objective truth. They just, you know, they just struggle with that. They can't, you know, they can't wrap their head around it. And even when I teach bioethics also. So even when I use, you know, Aristotle to kind of explain why we in the Catholic tradition from the moment of conception, natural law says this is a human being. And because substance, you know, matter and form have come together, we have a substantial change. And then I talk about all the other things along the way until we die or just accidental changes. We are who we are from the moment of conception. And they'll look at me and go, no, yeah. I mean, like it kind of makes sense to them. And then when I even use a scientific approach by Dr. Maureen Kondik on how this is a human being from the moment of conception, talking about it through a biological lens of an organism, okay, they got it. And then you shift gears to go into the topic of abortion, and well, it's fine. You know, there's no problem with abortion. And it's like, what happened? It's like they can't. Even though they want to believe there is something objective, I think there's something in them that is, I can't tell you that's true. I can't tell somebody else that's true.
That's a great point, Pat. And I think I really liked what you highlighted at the end there about they want to.
Yeah.
And yet there's something blocking them. In the second and third part of this series, I refer to this as a failure to launch. So there's something inside
like that
of them that is innate and God-given. Because every single one of us is made in the divine image, we have these fundamental longings in our nature. And one of them is for truth. We long for truth just as much as we long to satisfy our stomachs, to eat, to drink water. It's equally connatural to us. And yet, in a relativistic culture, that feeling is consistently being squelched by other feelings, namely a sort of despair, perhaps, that maybe there's an absurdity to the way I am. It would be nice to know what the good life is or if there's a God. And yet, I think we have to grow up in the same way that when I was a child, I thought it might be nice if there's a Santa, and then I got disabused of that notion. Well, now I've grown up and I've seen many, many, many intelligent, good people disagree about fundamental issues. Who am I to make a judgment about these things?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a deep lack of confidence that such judgments are possible. I mean, I think back, and I'm sure you're very familiar with this, from St. Thomas Aquinas, who says, whatever is received according to the mode of the receiver.
Mm.
In other words, however you are, that's how things appear to you.
Right.
And so it doesn't surprise me at all that your students can hear sophisticated arguments for why, let's say, an embryo is a human organism, right, in the full intelligibility of humanity, and yet not be able to make the next judgment connect, have the insight that this has sort of ethical implications, because they just can't receive it that way.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to recognize that, you know, because we have these categories in our moral theology of vincible ignorance and invincible ignorance, the point of this is not to say these are morally evil students or anything like that.
No, no.
There absolutely is a block here, right? Mm-hmm. What Bernard Lonergan calls a bias, a blind spot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of our goal in introductory theology has to be doing the sort of work that can begin removing this blind spot as much as is possible within our means.
Right. So I wasn't familiar. You use a quote from Smith and I can't even read my own handwriting.
Patricia Snell.
Yeah, Snell.
Smith
Snell.
Patricia Snell.
That's right. And I never thought of this. And you kind of say, let's describe it as the law of difference in relativism. Will you kind of explain this to the audience and then we can take off with it?
Sure, absolutely. So what I define as the law of difference in relativism is that for persons who don't have epistemological foundations, and just for the audience, in case anyone's not sure what that means, I just mean if you don't have a clear philosophical sense of how we come to know what's true and what's false, the very experience of intense diversity will almost inevitably turn you into a relativist.
Yep.
And so it's simply inevitable growing up in a pluralistic culture. And I want to note, I don't think there's a problem with a pluralistic culture.
Mm-hmm.
But growing up in a pluralistic culture where there are many different ideas of what the good life is, just growing up in that, if you don't have foundations for sorting through different views and coming to judgments of truth, right, that you feel like these are the correct judgments and here's why I know that they're correct, et cetera, just a preponderance of difference is going to provoke in a person certain feelings.
Right.
Right. And maybe feelings that we would even say are virtuous in some sense under certain conditions, such as humility. Right. And saying, well, who am I to make these judgments? I mean, I know people who are a lot smarter than I am.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And they've come to different conclusions. Right. Also, a feeling of tolerance, which in its proper context, right, is a virtue.
Right.
And so I think just being exposed to so much diversity inevitably triggers relativism if you don't have a way of sorting through it. And I'll just give one example that I didn't mention in the article. I have students, when I bring this up, I say, well, is just the fact that people disagree a sign that there's no truth about a matter? And many of them will say yes. And then I ask them, well, certainly there are people who believe that the earth is flat, but you haven't given up your belief that the earth is round,
right?
And many of them will say, well, I mean, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
And then some of them will say, no, that can't be right. That can't be right. So it's very interesting. Some of them will bite the bullet and go all the way. And others will say, well, no, because you can answer questions about science, but you can't answer questions about what we would call metaphysics or epistemology or ethics or anything like that. And so it reveals some fundamental assumptions of our culture, namely that what's real is the stuff that I can touch and bump into.
Mm-hmm.
And so since I can touch and bump into physical stuff or look at it with microscopes or telescopes, then I can adjudicate questions about that. And the flat earther really is just crazy.
Right.
But some of them are even not so sure about their ideas of what leads to truth. So they think, well, if somebody sees it differently, then I guess they see it differently. And who am I to tell the flat earther that he's wrong?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that law of difference, I think, is explanatory in some way. I don't know whether you find it explanatory or in your own experience.
I do. And I think one of the things that kind of sat with me as I read this was that idea that so many kids start this kind of relativism more so when they go to college, because they're exposed to a lot of more, you know, like I think of where I'm from, you know, it's a predominantly Catholic community. Most families are together. Everybody kind of sees things the same way. And you go to college and you're exposed to all of these different ideas and ways of dealing with things, and even just different color hair, you know, all this stuff that you've never experienced before. And obviously you're not going to look at all those people and say, well, they're all bad or they're all wrong or they're all evil. So that opens you up to this idea of, well, how can I be right then? And it, So that really, I think just that alone moves people outside their comfort zone, and they don't know how to deal with it. They don't know. And then they just kind of push it into every area of their lives. And if anything gets difficult or if they're challenged in any way, it's much easier then to say, well, you know, well, if that's what you want to think, if that's your truth, then okay, that's fine. You know, And so my thing is that you talk about some, I want to get this in before we run out of time, because I could talk to you forever. So you talk about intellectual conversion, teaching for intellectual conversion. So is your idea that, first of all, you have to kind of attack relativism before intellectual conversion can even begin?
Yeah, so let me clarify what I mean by intellectual conversion for the audience, and then connect it to your question. I think there's two paths to take, knowing that, you know, our students are going to encounter so much diversity and difference. One is to plunge into a fundamentalism that says we have to shelter them from this.
Right.
I think that's a dead end. It's not virtuous fundamentally, and it's just going to backfire.
Right.
It will not work.
Right.
We shouldn't will that or desire that for our students. So then the question becomes, well, this is clearly something we have to move through. Every person needs to move through, not around.
Right.
So what do we do with this difference? What I have found to be useful in my own life as I wrestled with these questions was the work of Bernard Lonergan, once again, a Jesuit philosopher and theologian who spoke about intellectual conversion. And what's important about intellectual conversion, and really key to understand, is that it is not fundamentally the replacement of one philosophical position with another.
Okay.
In other words, it is not to replace relativism with objective moral realism, let's say, or objectivism, realism about metaphysical truths, etc.
Okay.
That is the fruit of intellectual conversion. But I'm interested in the tree, namely, who are the subjects, who are the people who find views attractive, who actually formulate views? Because philosophical views don't exist out there, just kind of floating in the world,
mm-hmm.
right? And I can't point my students to physical evidence, let's say, that moral objectivism is true. I can say, well, look, you live like a moral realist.
Mm-hmm.
You can't actually consistently live like a moral relativist, et cetera.
Right.
And that's all fine and good. But if the criterion for what's real is still what you can touch, what you can see,
mm-hmm.
then there's really no way to get out of this problem. Instead, the solution is what Lonergan calls a philosophical experience, what I call a therapy.
Okay.
An attending to your own desire for truth and seeing how it concretely unfolds.
Oh.
If you...
You know, I'm sorry. We are out of time. This was so fast. I am going to talk to you again, Dr. Roberto De Novo. Thank you for being with us.